This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Speaking of healthcare reform here in America, let's get a little historic context, shall we, and learn a little bit. Christy Ford Chapin joins me live in studio. She's a graduate student at the University of Virginia and a PhD candidate. A candidate for her doctorate in the Department of History at the University of Virginia. And you are studying the history of healthcare in America, right? And in the period we really want to know about, which is in the 20th century.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. Good stuff. So let's start, if we can, with like a, you know, just a Christy 101. Where are you from? And how did you end up studying history at UVA?
Well, Coy, thank you very much for having me on the program. I am a Virginian. I went to William & Mary. I'm following the path of Jefferson from William & Mary to UVA. And I ended up at UVA because I graduated with a government degree from William & Mary and then decided to study modern political economy in the UVA history department.
Good deal. And you are, is it a fellowship at the Miller Center? What is that?
That's right. I really want to make a shout out here to the Miller Center Fellowship Program. It's the Governing America in the Global Era, the GAGE Fellowship Program. What they do is they bring in junior scholars who are working on very promising projects, and they pay for them to just focus for 1 year on their research and their writing. And it's just a great place to be. The people who run the center, the scholars there, they bring in the top academics and scholars from around the country to come in and speak, and we get an opportunity just to have a great scholarly environment over there.
And your dissertation advisor is the one, the only, Brian Ballow, a regular guest on this program. We really enjoy Brian on the radio. He's just fantastic and amazing as a scholar as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So I got to read this. This is your proposed dissertation title, Ensuring America's Health, Publicly Constructing the Private Health Insurance Industry, 1945 to 1970. So that's the title. But what you're looking at really is how healthcare in America, as we know it, came to be. Because it was invented, right? I mean, whether it's public or private, we all created it, right?
Absolutely. So what I do is I start in the post-World War II period because I think that's a really critical and often overlooked period. A lot of people start with Medicare and Medicaid or the period afterwards. And I look at really 1945, Truman, and then the Eisenhower era and say, wait a second, we really need to look at this period of time because this is when the private healthcare industry, the foundation for what we have today was laid down.
Yeah. And what was it before? Did it was there, like, what happened if you got sick in the 30s? I mean, what was it like?
Well, it's really interesting.
And don't, you wouldn't have to spend the whole hour on this, but just as a as an introduction. So, you know, we all sort of know what it is like now. Mm-hmm. And it was born after World War II. Healthcare came through your employer. And we'll talk about how that was created. But before that, what was the majority of healthcare in America? How did folks get it?
Well, the interesting thing about healthcare before World War II, a lot of people know that the American Medical Association, or the AMA, fought against a nationalized health program. What a lot of people don't realize is they also fought the free market. They were very afraid about being brought into a corporate structure. They were afraid, for example, of becoming like the engineers, being brought into the corporation. So because of that, the AMA wouldn't allow any type of financing experiments. They really wanted to keep it on that 19th century independent practice, the one doctor practicing alone, and then the patient bartering however they could with the physician. They didn't want any third parties, any corporations. So while there were a lot of people attempting to do financing experiments, whether it be doctor groups trying to accept monthly payments from subscribers or patients, or it be unions trying to run healthcare plans, or company doctors, or consumer cooperatives, the AMA would roll in and make sure they were shut down by having physicians' licenses withdrawn or having their hospital privileges
Wow.
rescinded. So
they're very powerful back before World War II.
Oh, very powerful.
So we're talking with Christy Ford Chapin at the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. So then what happens after World War II? I read somewhere that employers started offering health care because they were so hungry for workers. Is that what happened? How did we get to a point where you could get health care from an employer so readily?
Okay, so there was pretty much a big vacuum in the market. And so World War II came around, and there was a wage cap placed in order to control inflation. So employers very rationally said, well, why don't we take advantage of these federal tax breaks and start trying to win over workers with fringe benefits? Because it benefited them tax-wise to do that. And of course, one of these fringe benefits was health insurance. And during the late 1930s and the early 1940s, AMA leaders very reluctantly said, okay, we've opposed insurance for decades, but now we're going to say, okay, we'll accept insurance. It was very reluctant. And so at this point, when employers started purchasing health insurance for workers, well, what organization was going to have the requisite financial reserves to fund healthcare services for these large national employee groups? Well, the only organizations left standing were the insurance companies, because the AMA had prevented any development in the market.
So the insurance companies just step in to fill that gap and say, okay, we're supplying insurance for like fire on your home. We can make a deal with employers to do the same and sort of act as a middleman between employers and their employees and doctors. Is that right?
Yes. But what's really important to recognize about this step is that insurance executives were very wary about even getting into the health insurance business. And pretty much everybody at the time, whether they be on the left ideologically, the right ideologically, everybody recognized that this was an inherently costly, expensive system and that there would be problems.
Yeah. So how did it happen? Was it fits and starts, or was it just a huge explosion right away?
It was a pretty big, huge explosion because of the war and because modern medicine, consumers were demanding healthcare financing products so that they could access the penicillin, the new line antibiotics, the x-rays, the cancer treatments. And because the AMA, the Chamber of Commerce, business groups, insurance companies, basically, in order to beat back the Truman Plan for universal federally managed and financed healthcare, all these private interests decided, okay, we're going to push insurance company financed healthcare. And so especially if you have the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers even sending out directives to their member companies saying, you really need to move into healthcare so we can try to save this one sector of the economy from the federal government and federal intervention.
So it sounds familiar to the debate today, and we'll talk more about the comparisons with the debate today. But it's interesting that folks may not know, a lot of folks may not know, if you're like me and you were born after this time, that Truman was advocating for some type of what was it, like a single payer or a government sponsored program?
Yes, the Truman plan was a single payer universal program.
And sort of like France.
Yes. And of course, we haven't seen anything like that for a long time. It cropped up again in the 70s. But one thing I'm uncovering in my research that's really been overlooked is policymakers. There was such a consensus about the fact the insurance company financing of healthcare was a problem and was too expensive, that even throughout the Eisenhower administration, there were numerous reform proposals from a lot of various policymakers, whether, again, they be on the left or the right. So you had moderate Republicans, moderate Democrats, everybody trying to offer some, and Eisenhower himself trying to offer some type of reform in order to broaden the base of the population that could actually afford this costly health insurance.
Yeah, so it was a huge political hot potato then and now.
Yes, yes. But I think also, just so that the audience understands why insurance company financing was so inherently expensive and what everybody at the time was so concerned about, which is cropping out up again now in debates, is that and the reason insurance company executives were so wary to initially get into the financing was that health insurance violates the fundamental insurance principle of moral hazard, which states that you cannot profitably insure something if the user can control their frequency of use. So they understood that, hey, patients can demand procedures and services they don't necessarily need. They're not tied to it. They can just have the insurer pay it. And the insurance companies couldn't supervise and dictate to physicians what they could and couldn't do, especially back then. Now we know.
That would come later.
Yeah, exactly. Over time, they had to develop expertise in healthcare and go far beyond actually just managing risk to actually coordinating and managing the entire system.
Yeah. And arguably rationing care. I mean, that's truly what insurance companies do today. They do ration care. I mean, we do have that now. We have rationed care. It's called the insurance industry.
Absolutely. And even more than that, I think a lot of people don't even realize that if your physician wants to treat you one way, but your insurance company dictates a certain treatment blueprint, they're probably not even going to mention it to you or say anything because they have to treat you the way through this blueprint or they will not get reimbursed.
Yeah, so they might not even bring up, I would like to do it this way, but they'll just say, this is what we're going to do because he knows business-wise, this is what I can do.
And you can imagine how that really hurts with innovation and experimentation and trying new things or even just tailoring something to the specific needs of a patient.
We are talking with Christy Ford Chapin of the University of Virginia. She is a doctoral candidate in the Department of History and a fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs, and we're honored to have her live in studio. She's writing her dissertation as we speak about the history, the 20th century history of public and private health care in America, and really the birth of the health insurance business, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it is just totally amazing. So when did we get to a point? So this starts after World War II. When did we get to a point where the government comes back to the table and says, okay, private industry, we need to fix that, or we need to have a little something called Medicare, Medicaid? When did that come along?
Well, as I was saying earlier, one thing that scholars have overlooked is the fact that even once the AMA and private interests defeated the Truman Plan, the healthcare issue never went away because of the costs. So all throughout the Eisenhower administration, you had numerous proposals coming up, and but pretty immediately within the Social Security Administration during the Truman era, they decided, okay, why don't we go ahead and try a different strategy? And what we'll go for is just trying to offer some type of insurance for the elderly because we can demonstrate that they need it the most. It's most difficult for them to get it because, of course, they're going to have to pay such high premiums because they use so much care. So that started very early on. But really, it was about the late 1950s when the Medicare and, well, it was really the Medicare debates because Medicaid kind of got thrown in at the last minute.
Oh, it did.
But
okay.
The Medicare debates started cropping up in the late 50s and then, of course, heated up once Kennedy was in office, so after 1960.
So tell us about those debates, which I imagine were just as big then as the current debate is now. Was it a national discussion that was as heated as it is now about government getting involved in healthcare?
Well, yes, it was a very big issue. And of course, as you can imagine, the cries from the private interests, the screams about socialized medicine and communism, and it was a very big ordeal. But the thing that's important to remember about the Medicare debates is all that was being proposed throughout the 1960s until the very last minute was a very small scale program of just hospitalization benefits for the elderly. So
the government, the advocate said, this is a totally limited thing. This isn't France. This isn't a single payer, huge. This isn't everybody. It's just old people when they go to the hospital.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
So
is that how they got it through?
I think it really helped because you had, Republicans and middle class people saying, hey, you know, I can't afford, you know, to help my mom or dad buy their health insurance. It was really difficult. I mean, you had over half of the elderly did have some form of insurance, but that left a very large portion of them that didn't have it. But I think for them politically, it worked really well, especially because the conservatives who opposed the bill and the private interests who opposed the bill made a tactical error when they started criticizing the legislation because it was too meager and saying, oh, it's just hospitalization benefits. They kept bringing this up over and over. So kind of at the last minute, the House Ways and Means Chairman Wilbur Mills was able to say, well, okay, we'll expand it to also include insurance for physician services. And on top of that, we'll also throw in Medicaid for indigent care. So that was the famous three-layer cake move where you had first hospitalization benefits for the elderly, second physician services for the elderly, and then third Medicaid for the poor.
We're talking with Christy Ford Chapin of the University of Virginia about the history of how healthcare as we know it in America came to be. So this all happened, what, late 50s, 1960, right in there?
Well, the Medicare debates really started to heat up in 1958. And then after Kennedy was elected in 1960. So 1960 and then Medicare and Medicaid were passed in 1965. So it took them five painful years.
Wow.
Through, yes, House and Senate, you know, tens of thousands of pages of committee hearings. And
that
lots
you get
of
to read now.
Exactly.
Historic research. Yeah, that's great. So where was Kennedy on all this? Was he an advocate for government really getting involved in healthcare?
Yes, he was. And it was one of, it was a very important part of his platform. And so when he was elected, he came. Now, he had a lot of items on the domestic agenda. And I think we see that today. You know, what do presidents decide to get behind? When do they push it? And he was in a difficult position because I brought up the House Ways and Means Chairman, Wilbur Mills. He was a Democrat in his party, but he was a Southern Democrat. So tended to be much more conservative on, say, welfare state proposals. So Kennedy was kind of in an awkward position of how much he could push it and win. So as he was trying to push through other things that had to do with trade and taxes, he kind of had to wait and very wisely bide his time until Wilbur Mills came around and started fighting for it with him. And that's one thing I think people lose sight of is the politicking and how you have to get it through the House and then the different various committees and the territory and who gets it and then the Senate and then the conference. So
yeah, it's huge.
Yes.
I am fascinated by the fact that really this debate is the debate that we're having now is so American. You know, it's to what extent should government be involved? And of course, we're talking about Medicare. I think it's my understanding that what the president is proposing, and it looks like this public option now might be dead. But what he's proposing is that basically Medicare no longer just be for old people, but that public option would be make something like Medicare available to anybody who wants it.
Well, I've spent a lot of time reading the House bill, and for reasons I won't get into here, at first I didn't really buy into the idea that the public option was there to kill off the private sector, to kill off the private insurance companies. But after I read the bill, I changed my views because the way it's set up is they are going to have a tiering system. This healthcare exchange. And so what you would have is theoretically the public option competing with insurance companies in each tier. You just have a basic plan that people can buy into. And I assume that would be for the lower income. You have to at least have a basic plan and then a better plan, the best, and then the supremo, absolute greatest plan ever. But the thing that caught my attention was the fact that the Secretary of Health and Human Services not only gets to dictate what benefits will be covered in each tier, but also the price of the package. And so I think Obama has gotten a lot of criticism from people on the left who said, oh, he's not going fast enough to a single payer federally managed system that will, you know, bring about more efficiency because the government will be able to be in charge of everything. But my reading of the bill is that, and now this is just the House bill, I must say, that I'm talking about. There are four different
proposals.
There's
other versions. Yeah,
yeah, there's four proposals floating around in the Senate. And when President Obama says his bill, it's difficult to know which one he's talking about. I'm assuming it's the House one since that's the only one that's out there for us to look at right now.
So it would be this public option would be in direct competition with private industry, private insurance companies providing health care. And conceivably, you can see a situation where they would constantly be able to lowball them and come in cheaper.
Right. Well, all the Secretary of Health and Human Services would have to do is just say that the insurance companies have to sell their packages in each tier for an unreasonably low price, and voila, they would have to exit the business. But I know that's very controversial right now, but from my reading of the bill, that it seems pretty clear. But who knows what will happen? Because yesterday, of course, there was a lot of talk that they're going to drop the public option and maybe look at some of the plans that are being thrown around in the Senate. And there's a lot of different things going on there too. A lot of compromise proposals. For instance, I think one that's gaining steam is the idea of putting people on a system that is more similar to what the congressmen actually have, where they can choose amongst many, many different insurance company options. But of course, I'm concerned about staying on this high cost, inefficient insurance company financed and driven model.
Yeah. And let's talk more about that model and how it came to be so outrageously expensive and where care came to be so rationed, and you had people in cubicles 2,000 miles away making some of your health care decisions for you. Let's talk about that with Christy Ford Chapin after a break here for local news and weather. We'll continue this conversation. Let's rejoin our conversation with Christy Ford Chapin of the University of Virginia Department of History and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. She is a doctoral candidate writing her dissertation on how healthcare in America came, as we know it, came to be, as it was created after World War II up until 1970. Let's go to the phones really quick. Mimi, you get the Patience Award, Mimi, waiting on line one. Mimi, you go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Coy. Once again, people are probably going to think that I am really creepy and mean, but I still say, and as your guest has said, you know, how healthcare has been, how the government has tried to step into it for decades, I still say that no one should get healthcare from the government, period. The government should pay for nothing. That people get what they can pay for. Sooner or later, we're going to have people demanding that they have BMWs because somebody else has one. And that's how the health care is. And when you tell us that we're paying for it anyway, I say, well, let's. How is that happening? Is that because we're paying for illegal immigrants that go to the emergency room or people who have no insurance that go to the emergency room? And while it may sound horribly cruel, you don't service them. You simply don't service them. And maybe they will get the idea that they have to take care of themselves, get their own health care, find a free clinic. I'm all for supporting free clinics, people who have catastrophic need and have no insurance. I'm all for, you know, having radio ads and everything else to help these people out, and let's get some money together. And I know we can do it in Charlottesville, and I know we can do it everywhere else. But none of these people deserve health insurance because they simply are. It's not a right. There are just, that's like saying the world owes me a living. You don't do that.
Mimi, thank you so much. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
Just had a statement.
a statement is fine as well. Mimi, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, I appreciate it. We're talking with Christy Ford Chapin of the University of Virginia. So I've heard this many times. People say, well, you know what, we better reform it now and everybody pay in to cover everybody, because the way the system has evolved today with the private health insurance companies, we are all paying anyway. We pay for the people who are, you know, if your neighbor doesn't have health care, you're paying. It's built into your premium that you have. You're paying to cover them. There's an extra cost built in. Is that true? And explain this to us.
Yes, it's known as cost shifting. Basically, I think to the caller's point is we're definitely, as a society, I would think most people would tend to say they don't want people to show up at emergency rooms and be denied care. And in fact, that is the law. You cannot deny health care to somebody. But there is what's known as cost shifting. So if somebody who is poor shows up to the emergency room, or an illegal immigrant or whatever, and the hospital has to eat the cost, where they're going to shift it over to the paying customer. And that would be the people who have insurance. And this also happens to a large degree when Medicare and Medicaid patients are reduced to a hospital. They can, in some cases, depending how it's done, make the hospital run more efficiently. But also, if it starts to cut into their budgets too much, they'll just try to shift a portion of those costs over to the insured patient.
So they just look at any revenue stream they have and put the burden there.
Yes.
To cover with the care they are providing where there is no revenue stream. And that's tens of millions of people.
Yes, yes. But I would also say that the way a lot of these, just because of the way the system has revolved, evolved around the insurance company financing models, is you do see a lot of inefficiency in the way doctors practice medicine and the way hospitals are set up and run, because there simply is no incentive to monitor that bottom line by the physicians and the nurses and the caregivers in those institutions.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, that the incentive is not there to save money or to be fiscally responsible at all. As a matter of fact, the incentive is there to charge for every test you can possibly run and to get as much money out of Medicare and Medicaid as you possibly can, right?
Yes, yes. And so really what we need to look at is how incentives are structured. You want the patient and the physician to be incentivized correctly so that excessive procedures and services aren't given just because, hey, that's the way I need to, that's the way I earn my money.
Yeah. How did we get to the point? We're talking with Christy Ford Chapin of the University of Virginia. How did the system evolve from the 1940s, when insurance companies were very reluctant to get involved in health insurance, to a point where it's a huge part of the economy and you have people in cubicles 2,000 miles away on the phone with, you know, an office manager or a doctor saying, no, you can't do that. We are not going to cover this. You can't do that procedure.
Well, that's a great question, because when insurance companies started getting involved, say, let's take it back to 1950, at first they wouldn't even get involved with physician services or any first dollar treatments. They weren't going to pay for you to go to a physician's office, for example, or really they just wanted to keep it to hospitalization costs or catastrophic costs if you got in a car accident or something and you were put in the hospital, but you'd have to pay a large deductible and a large copayment in order so that you're concerned about the cost. You're trying to keep them down. You're trying to work with the hospital and the physician to keep down excessive services and procedures. But as I was saying before, in order to beat back numerous reform proposals that even after Truman's plan was defeated, the universal program that we talked about earlier, even after his program was defeated, you had myriad of proposals coming from Republicans and moderate Democrats. And so in order to continue to beat back these proposals, they had to grow this insurance company, this private healthcare system, and show policymakers, see, look, we've spread and liberalized insurance company policies have gotten better. Now they're covering first dollar costs.
Because the government said, if you don't do it, we will.
Exactly. And so it became this race. Who's going to win, the private sector or the federal government? And so it was this really, the private interests were very much aware of what they were doing. Every meeting they got together said, we have to do more. We have to insure more people, give them more benefits, first dollar, last dollar, everything you can imagine. This is what the people are demanding, or the federal government is going to step in. Well, in 1950, insurance companies didn't know anything about healthcare. They didn't even have reliable morbidity tables to tell them how to even price these premiums. But over since 1950, over the last 5 or 6 decades, what you've had is they've had to become experts in healthcare. They've had to learn about 1,200 different conditions and all the different symptoms and how long will that be in the hospital, and we're going to give the doctor permission for this many days, and what's the treatment blueprint for this diagnosis. And so it's very strange the way they've gone from, insurers are what? They're underwriters of risk. But no, now they've had to become these experts in healthcare and manage and coordinate an entire system.
Yeah, amazing. It really is. So the person in the cubicle on the phone is no dummy.
It's probably a nurse. Yeah. A lot. That's what, like, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, a lot of the big, they hire nurses. So trying to at least give, you know, show that they have a little respect, you know. And you have your medical director who is running a big department of provider relations and representatives who go from the insurance company out to the physician offices and tell them how the policies have changed. And, of course, you know, in the physician's offices, you have a bevy of administrators who are trying to figure out all the different paperwork works and what the doctor can do and can't do and how he can bill and all the various paperwork.
Yeah. So and they basically have a series of round pegs that they have created, and it's a one size fits all based on the averages and the numbers and the tables and everything. And there's not a lot of room for special cases.
No, there isn't. And they really, I mean, you got to think, in order to try to keep costs down, which, as you can see, we still haven't done a good job of, this was all that they really could do. Yeah. They really weren't left with any other
options.
And this
was the fear from the very beginning. This is going to be too expensive for America, for everybody involved. This is going to be too expensive, and it's going to open up way too much opportunity for waste and fraud. They thought this in the 40s.
Yes, everybody recognized this. And I guess one thing that a myth I want to overturn is, a lot of people think, oh, healthcare costs didn't become a problem until after the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. And that is incorrect. It was constantly brought up as a problem. Everybody recognized it. It didn't matter if you were a Republican, Democrat, policymaker on what side, was very well recognized.
Yeah. Amazing. So what's your fix? What do you think we should do? We're talking with Christy Ford Chapin. She's a doctoral candidate at the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs, studying how healthcare in America came to be after World War II. what do we need to, I mean, clearly there's problems. There's enormous problems. So, I mean, I applaud anybody, whether it's public or private sector, that stands up and will say that. There's a lot of things that could be better that we could fix. I don't agree with everybody on all the fixes, but what do you say? What do you think, what's your prescription for what should we be doing?
Well, I think, you know, of course, the two goals that everybody would agree on is equity and efficiency. And I think the way you get there is you have a universal system. And being a historian, I would go back and rip a page from history and look at what the market tried to do before the AMA shut various financing experiments down. What doctors were attempting to do was to form doctor groups. And basically, they were cutting out the insurance company by directly accepting the monthly payment or the insurance premium payment from the patient. And these were doctor groups, so they didn't have fragmented care that you have today, where your cardiologist isn't talking to your general practitioner and isn't talking to the orthopedist. These doctor groups had one of each specialty, and you'd have your pediatricians. And for complicated cases, for example, you could get together and talk about a patient and how's the cardiologist treating them and what does the GP think and what's the surgeon going to do. And so they were trying to own the insurance policy themselves. Now, the way this would have developed is insurance companies wouldn't have gone away. They still would have been in healthcare, but doctor groups would have bought reinsurance with them. So say a patient of theirs went over $500,000 in 1 year, then their insurance would kick in. But what this does is it lines up the incentives in a correct way. So the doctor is not incentivized just to do as many procedures and services as possible. However, at the same time, if word gets out that a doctor group is withholding care, well, you can imagine they're not going to have any business. Yeah. So it starts to align the incentives in the correct way.
With some free market solutions and not necessarily government prescriptions for how you should act.
Right, exactly. I think the thing with a lot of the market solutions that are out there now is they just don't fundamentally restructure the market. Things like health savings accounts, that's great for the young and the healthy. Problem is we're not spending a lot of money on the young and the healthy. About 20% of people make up about 80% of the healthcare system's cost. So we need to look at something that really fundamentally transforms the way everything is working. And I think that's the reason a lot of these free market solutions just haven't really been quite up to.
Because they're not really addressing what the real problems are.
Right.
And where the real bulk of the expense is. And so much of that expense is actually towards the end of life, right?
Yes, exactly. And the elderly. So going back to our talk about Medicare, and that is why it was such a salient issue for people and continues to be. So that's the kind of system I would like to see, is a system of doctor groups where the doctor has to be. Now, for physicians, this would be difficult because they'll be forced to compete. Now, you've got to realize right now, physicians who are a bit on the marginal side can't get a lot of patients. They like the insurance company financing system because they can just simply pad bills, order more procedures and services. This is the reason we have a problem with not having enough doctors in rural areas. If everybody wants to live in Washington, D.C., well, there's nothing keeping some of the physicians and saying, sorry, you're not competing well enough in this market. You need to go elsewhere and make a living someplace else. This would solve a lot of the problems in the rural areas.
Yeah. And again, why aren't there more doctors in rural areas?
Well, because
it's just not a lot of money there?
Well, there doesn't need to be. You really have to want to go be a country doctor. Most people want to live in big metropolitan areas and be near the nice restaurants.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Their wife wants to go to the opera.
Christy Ford Chapin is with the University of Virginia's Department of History and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. She's writing her dissertation. It's titled Insuring America's Health, Publicly Constructing the Private Health Insurance Industry, 1945 to 1970. It's a fascinating, fascinating topic. Now, got to ask you this, though. These death panels. Sarah Palin says there's death panels. This plan is going to create these panels of people that will decide who lives and who dies and if you can save grandma's life. And I've read enough to know this is bogus. Where does this come from, and what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that everybody, no matter how little you know about healthcare, recognizes that we have serious cost problems. So the so-called death panels was just, hey, you can have end-of-life counseling. I think everybody thinks that's reasonable. Everybody thinks it's a reasonable thing to maybe sit down with your family and your physician and talk about how it is that you want to die and how long you want to be kept alive. A lot of people are very worried about being kept alive for months on end.
I mean, truth be told, there's a lot of families out there, including mine, that have had end-of-life counseling for a loved one who has a terminal disease. It's nice to be able to sit down with your doctor and find out what's the prognosis. I mean, what can happen? What's going to happen? What should we tell us what we need to keep an eye out for and give us a timetable and that kind of education that you definitely need? That who gets this? I didn't know this stuff.
Yes. And so that's what I think people are concerned about, is because they know that there are costs or problems. So I think no matter what happens with reforms, the main fundamental issue is if we don't get control of costs one way or the other, whether it's by insurance companies or the government, there's going to be some type of rationing.
Yeah. Christy Ford Chapin is with the University of Virginia and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. Thank you, Christy. We're going to take a break for CBS News, local news, and weather. This conversation will be podcast at WINA.com and CVillePodcast.com as well. Y'all have a great night.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit CVillePodcast.com for more.